Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Reardon. And Ron, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, Ken.
Have you noticed
when we don't do the podcast for a couple weeks, nothing happens?
That's right. Nothing happens. There's not much to talk about this week.
So that's it for this week's political podcast.
Well, actually, I have a listing of three senators who have not announced their retirement.
That would be the shorter way to do it. I do think we need to talk about the senators who are not running for re-election. But first, I want to throw out this one prospect that is an intriguing prospect for a lot of Republicans and a lot of conservatives. And that is that the Massachusetts Senate race to replace Teddy Kennedy's appointed replacement,
less than
Paul
2 weeks,
Kirk,
January 19th,
just 2 weeks away, has closed up. The first real polling that we've seen since the primary in December is showing that Martha Coakley, the presumed automatic winner in such a blue Democratic state, only has a modest lead.
Rasmussen poll shows it 50-41, a 9-point lead. Most people feel that what's wrong with Martha Coakley is that she's coasting to this anointment, that she's not taking it seriously, whereas Scott Brown is going after the independents, he's going after the Tea Party folks.
Well, he's got some great ads up where he tries to link himself to the Kennedy legacy himself.
There's also, by the way, speaking of Kennedy, there's an independent candidate on the ballot named Joe Kennedy. And I wonder how that's going to go, because if it's 50-41, perhaps Joe Kennedy is getting at least 3 or 4 points there. And I wonder if some Democrats think that might be the other Joe Kennedy.
Or they might just think it's some Kennedy, they don't much care for Martha Coakley. Now, does she have a problem with the voters of Massachusetts herself?
I don't think she does. And, of course, she's been elected statewide as a state attorney general. But the Rasmussen poll showed that 65% of independents are backing Scott Brown. And I thought that's pretty remarkable.
Especially in a state where, as is often overlooked, roughly half of the voters do not identify with either the Republican Party or the Democratic Party. They always talk about how there are only 12% Republicans in the state. The Democrats are not a majority either.
The headline of the week, and this probably shouldn't be headlines because it should be more like a dog bites man, is that the Kennedy family, Vicky Kennedy, the widow of Ted Kennedy, and Joseph Kennedy III, the former congressman, has endorsed Martha Coakley. And that's supposed to be big news.
Right. We supposedly knew that, though, didn't
we?
Well,
one would think that the Democratic Party is united, and they say that, you know, Martha Coakley will continue Ted's efforts on behalf of health care and things like that. I thought it was just interesting that, first of all, the endorsement comes 12 days before the special election, and I don't know why people are making such a big deal of it, but it did come much later than anybody expected. Another bit of endorsement this week, Kurt Schilling endorsed Scott Brown. Kurt Schilling's a registered independent, and he says, this was very upsetting to me for some reason, he said a Scott Brown victory would be akin to the Boston Red Sox defeating the New York Yankees in 2004, which upset me greatly.
I understand that was a great upset, and particularly to you. But all right, enough of Massachusetts. We'll check back in next week and see where that race seems to be going. It's certainly much more interesting and much more competitive than anyone expected it to be. And let's just note that were the Republicans to pull a great upset there in Massachusetts and win that seat, it would deprive the Democrats of their 60-vote majority in the Senate and throw serious doubts on completion of the health care legislation.
Well, a lot of people kept talking about why Barack Obama is doing all these things at once. Why is he filling up his plate with all this stuff? And the reason is because he will never have as many Democrats in the Congress, in the Senate and House, as he has now, certainly in 2010. He's not going to have in 2011. And two senators who will not be there in 2011 are Chris Dodd and Byron Dorgan.
That's right. Now, these are the first two elected Democratic incumbents to declare they're retiring in this cycle. Byron Dorgan from North Dakota had been presumably a candidate. There was really very little speculation about whether or not he would run, but there was a lot of speculation about whether the Republican governor of North Dakota, John Hoeven, might get into the race against him. And while Hoeven is never committed one way or the other, here we are in January, he still hasn't said what he wants to do. Apparently, Byron Dorgan thinks there's a pretty good chance Hoeven's going to get in, and Dorgan seems to be tired of the Senate.
I don't think that Dorgan got out because he wanted to avoid a tough race against Hoeven. As you say, we still don't know what Hoeven's going to do. Polls show that in a hypothetical matchup, Hoeven would do very well. Hoeven's not only in his third term as governor, a recent poll showed he had 87% approval rating.
That's a good rating.
The thought of somebody be called a popular governor
in this
country.
Now, that's even higher than the podcast. I think John Hoeven would be a formidable candidate in what will probably be a Republican year, in what is certainly a Republican state, against Byron Dorgan, who is a somewhat dispirited politician at 67.
Dorgan did say that he's had enough of it. The Senate's not working. He wants to spend more time with Ron Elving's family, which I thought was surprising.
I thought it was touching.
But also, I think a sign that the Republican Party is going to do very well. And first of all, North Dakota, let me just a quick little history of North Dakota. It was founded in... No, Ron, honey, The most important thing is that it has not elected a Republican to the Senate since 1980, and yet, presidential-wise, North Dakota has not voted for a Democratic presidential candidate.
Since 1964.
And before that, 1936. So it's been
Wow. Those were a couple of long-ago years.
Yes. So my only point is that in a such a red state, the fact that the Republicans have not elected the Senate in all this time, but a sign that it looks like it's going to be a very good Republican year, Earl Pomeroy, who's at-large congressman, because he's put on a lot of weight.
And also because they only get one in North Dakota.
Oh, is that what they meant by at-large?
So he has the whole
state.
That's
at-large. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, Earl Pomeroy was thought to be the likely Democratic candidate, and he said this week, no, not going to do it.
Right as soon as Dorgan was out of there, Pomeroy said, not me, I'm not running against John Hoeven. What an irony it would be if John Hoeven chose yet to stay as governor. He has two more years on that third term, and the seat wound up going to somebody else. And you know one person who does want to run is a person from the media, Ken.
Well, Ed Schultz, the MSNBC host, has been suggested by some Democrats as somebody he should come home to North Dakota and seek the Senate seat.
That's where Ed Schultz is from.
Yes, he is. And, of course, if he were from South Dakota, he would be returning to his peers. But that joke wouldn't work in North Dakota, nor would it work anywhere.
Nor would it work anywhere.
Except for the podcast.
All right. But let's just say this. This race we've been talking about so much, the Byron Dorgan race, that's not the one that got the big headlines. Why was that, Ken?
Well, two things. First of all, we will agree that the Dorgan decision not to run again is good news for the Republican Party. The other Democrat who announced he will not run, Christopher Dodd of Connecticut.
Christopher J. Dodd.
Who is the longest-serving senator in Connecticut history.
Since 1980.
The big news there is that he's not running, and that's good news for the Democrats.
Why could that be, Ken?
Well, because Chris Dodd's numbers have been awful all year long. Ever since he moved his family to Des Moines, when he was running to become president of Iowa. It was a very close race. He also...
He finished sixth, as I recall, in Iowa.
In a field of five. But also, he also got a questionable sweetheart mortgage.
Countrywide mortgage.
He pushed forward for AIG executives' bonuses.
Very good move. That was not a popular thing. Excellent political move.
He was criticized as being too close to the insurance industry, which is very potent in Connecticut.
Yes, it is. Hartford and so forth.
But he has not really addressed these issues. I mean,
he never really did. It was months before he gave a really good explanation of the countrywide sweetheart mortgage.
Right.
This is something he's acknowledged, that he did not handle this very well. And I think that here again we have a case of somebody who's been in the Senate for 30 years, who has seen it and done it, who is, shall we say, done in by the way the Senate has become in the last several years, not only the partisanship, but just the breakdown of the personal relationships between senators, that he's really ready to hang it up. But as you say, that's good news for the Democrats, partly because he was in such trouble and also because they have a very strong backup candidate to step right in, which he did on the day that Dodd announced.
The most popular politician in Connecticut is State Attorney General Richard Blumenthal, who has been rumored to be running for years. Democrats always wanted to run for something. Most people thought he was going to run against Lieberman in the primary in 2012.
And might have beaten him had he done so.
I think he would have beaten him in the primary, certainly if Lieberman were going to run as a Democrat, and that would be kind of funny.
That would be humorous at this point.
So Blumenthal will run. He will be the Democratic nominee, and suddenly all the Republican dreams of winning a Senate seat in Connecticut seem to be going by the wayside because Blumenthal has a tremendous strains that Dodd did not have.
So we see, in a sense, almost a wash here. A seat the Democrats had been counting on in North Dakota now looks Republican, and a seat the Republicans were really licking their chops over in Connecticut now looks like it's going to stay Democratic. And here's another strange case. A lot of people don't think that Kirsten Gillibrand is really in position to hold that Senate seat she was appointed to in New York to replace Hillary Clinton. And they've been looking around for someone to run against her in the Democratic primary there in New York. Ken, you're our New York expert. Which native New Yorker have they come up with to run against her?
Well, every native New Yorker who actually suggested themselves as a possible primary challenge was shooed away by Chuck Schumer, hence the name.
Ooh, very good.
The White House, Vice President Biden, they all said, no, look, Gillibrand is our choice. We're raising money for her. Stay out of the race.
And everybody got chased out.
Everybody got chased out.
So they had to go all the way to Tennessee
to find
somebody.
Well, that Tennessean, Harold Ford Jr., who lost a Senate seat in Tennessee in 2006.
Ran a very strong race in a good Democratic year and almost picked up that seat.
And I think the race is the key word there because race was perhaps one of the reasons he did not win statewide.
Harold, call me.
from that infamous
Certainly
ad.
A debatable and controversial point, but a lot of Democrats felt that he was done in on that basis.
He moved to New York. He's now a high-ranking official at Merrill Lynch, and he has told friends that he would very much like to run against Gillibrand in the primary.
Now, as an African-American, he would have automatic appeal to a lot of the Democrats in New York who are not happy with Gillibrand, both African-American Democrats and liberal Democrats who feel she doesn't represent them. So there is some plausibility to this, even though he would be, shall we say, a pretty obvious carpetbagging case.
First of all, New York is not known to elect carpetbaggers, as Hillary Clinton and Jim Buckley and Bobby Kennedy would tell you to the Senate. But more importantly, I think, look, just as Schumer has told everybody to stay out, I think he would do the same thing to Harold Ford. Although it's interesting to me for them to say Harold Ford to stay out, there is a specter of Andrew Cuomo challenging African-American Governor David Paterson, and yet there doesn't seem to be the same kind of Democratic pressure on Cuomo to stay out of it. Matter of fact, the White House has encouraged it, apparently.
But this could have something to do with David Paterson's abysmal numbers and the perception that he could actually somehow give back the governorship of New York to the Republicans through his sheer unpopularity.
But two things. You said earlier that Gillibrand's numbers are bad, but there is no likely Republican candidate. Rudy Giuliani, who was
mentioned, was
not going to do it.
That was another development since we were last on the podcast. Right. Ken, we didn't have a chance to do all of your usual Rudy Giuliani jokes because the man seems to be deciding to stay in private life.
Which is not a surprise because I think he wanted to make money. And two, I don't think his heart was ever in a Senate race. I think he always wanted to be governor. But if Andrew Cuomo is going to be the governor, he's not going to beat him. So there is no real Republican. George Pataki has been mentioned. Rick Lazio, who ran for the Senate against Hillary Clinton in 2000, is now running for governor, which I don't think he's going to do well either. But ultimately, Harold Ford Jr. says he'll decide in 45 days from the time of the New York Times report whether he will run or not. I suspect he will not run.
Okay, Chuck Schumer will probably notch his belt one more time.
Yeah, I do.
Kirsten Gillibrand will be the nominee. And in the absence of a really formidable Republican, she will probably bridge the gaps in her own party and get elected. That's one seat the Democrats may not have to worry about. Another one of the Democratic appointees who is obviously leaving a messy situation behind is Roland Burris in Illinois. Another big question mark for the Democrats as they try to hold on to their 60-seat majority. I don't think anybody expects it to be 60 in 2011, as you suggested earlier, but now the battle is over how far down in the 50s does it go. Roland Burris not running for re-election, but just keeps remaining in the picture and reminding everybody of Rod Blagojevich, who's going to go on trial in the coming months. Not a good year to be a Democrat, or is it, in Illinois?
Well, it's too soon to say. I mean, it depends on if there's going to be an ugly primary. The primary is coming up very soon. February 2nd opens up the 2010 primary season. The state treasurer there seems to be the anointed candidate, certainly, of Dick Durbin. But there is an African-American, Cheryl Jackson, who's also running in the primary. And it depends on if the party gets united. The Republicans seem to be coalescing behind Mark Kirk, the moderate congressman. And speaking of moderate congressmen, there's another state where the appointed senator is not going to run, and that's Ted Kaufman in Delaware. And that's another seat that Republicans should be feeling pretty good about.
Because Mike Castle is running.
Mike Castle is very popular. We do expect Beau Biden, the state attorney general and son of what's-his-name, to run as a Democratic nominee.
And if so, that becomes quite a race.
Absolutely.
Between the two most popular political names in the state, and in one case, a young, dynamic guy just back from Iraq. He's a veteran. He's the son of Joe Biden. And on the other hand, Mike Castle, who is a very well-liked, very moderate, longtime public servant in the state of Delaware. Really an unusual kind of matchup and one that'll test the Delaware voters' loyalties.
Clash of the Titans.
Yes, you could say, or Titans and Titan Tyros. All right, one more appointee among the Democrats. I think we're going to have hit them all, and that would be Michael Bennett in Colorado. How's he doing? He's got a primary.
Well, he does have a primary for now, and the reason I say for now is because the governor, Bill Ritter, who appointed Michael Bennett to replace Ken Salazar, announced this week that he is not going to run for a second term. That was a surprise as
well. Big surprise. Just a second term. He just got elected in 2006.
That's correct. And he was thought to be one of the new Democrats who made
face of the new West
Colorado,
Democrat.
If nothing else, a purple state from the red state of where it had
Well,
been.
I mean, it's a little more than that. You've got a Democratic governor. You've got
two
Democratic senators.
And five out of the seven House seats.
Five out of the seven House seats. Just a few years ago, right. That would have seemed impossible.
It was complete opposite. It was Colorado. Complete opposite, right.
And they also voted for Barack Obama for president after twice voting for George Bush. So it seemed that there had been a blue revolution in Colorado. Why would a guy just a couple of years into his first term decide he's not running for another?
He's had battles with the state legislature over taxes and over the budget. He is a pro-life Catholic who a lot of the more liberal wing of the Democratic Party were not crazy about, although the view on that is mixed. But also by naming Bennett to the Senate seat, he has alienated at least half of the Democratic Party.
That was the half that wanted to have the seat themselves.
And that half was Andrew Romanoff, who was running against Bennett in the primary. Now Romanoff may drop out of the Senate race, run for governor, so it may make some Democrats more happy. But Republicans are trying to dismiss Romanoff, who's a big liberal, or John Hickenlooper, who's the mayor of Denver, who's also a big liberal, as Denver liberals, big city Denver liberals. The Republican Party could see a little bit of a comeback in Colorado in 2010.
Yes, they've got a shot at the governorship. They've got a real shot against an appointed Democratic Senate incumbent. Really good chance for a comeback, and a couple of those House seats are going to be hard for the Democrats to defend in Colorado as well. So overall, we've got a lot of vulnerabilities for the Democrats in the Senate. We talked about the appointee situations. We talked about North Dakota. We've also got question marks over Blanche Lambert Lincoln in Arkansas and even Harry Reid in Nevada, even though he doesn't have an opponent yet. Everybody expects he's going to get one and he's going to get a real race out of it.
Well, every poll shows him with a less than 50% approval rating against an unnamed Republican opponent.
Which can be more attractive, actually.
That may be the case.
So in the end, you have a better part of 10 Democratic question marks. When you look at their lineup for 2010, the Republicans, of course, have 6 retiring members. There's George Lemieux in Florida, who's a stand-in the end of the Lemieux era.
I can't believe he's leaving.
He's a stand-in for Mel Martinez, who's already left. You've got Jim Bunning leaving in Kentucky. You've got Judd Gregg going out the door in New Hampshire. George Voinovich in Ohio.
Kit Bond in Missouri. Brownback.
And Sam Brownback in Kansas. I would submit the only one of those the Republicans can just completely put on cruise control is Kansas.
Is it because no Democrat has won a Senate seat there since 1932?
That would be one of the reasons, yes, as a matter of fact. And no Democrat is really emerging there in Kansas to break that particular scheme. There are a couple who might have had a shot. They're not running. So we've got 5 Republican vacancies that have some opportunity in varying degrees for the Democrats to pick them up, which makes it a very interesting Senate year because the numbers overall of Senate seats that are on the ballot are equal, 18 and 18. And then the number of vulnerables within that 18 is pretty similar as well.
You make a very good point that the headlines of this week have not made. All the headlines say the Democrats are in big trouble, and Dorgan, they're leaving, the Democrats are in disarray. And yet several months ago, when all those Republicans you mentioned decided to leave, well, then the Republicans were in big trouble and Obama was riding high.
You would almost think the media need a new story to jump on every month.
The point is, this is going to be a very topsy-turvy election year.
Topsy-turvy?
Topsy-turvy.
Could it be hurly-burly?
It could be hurdy-gurdy by Donovan.
The hurdy man comes singing songs of love. But enough of the Senate, Ken. What of your favorite chamber, the House?
One thing we haven't mentioned in our podcast, because the last podcast of 2009 we spent on saying farewell to some notable people who left us, but Parker Griffith, the conservative, very conservative freshman Democrat from northern Alabama, became a Republican.
And by making that party switch, in a sense, he gave the Republicans the first piece of really good news they've had in the interim between elections, because the special elections last year pretty much favored the Democrats. And the Republicans have been expecting to start seeing the wind blowing in their direction as we move into the midterm atmosphere. And this was really the first freshet of that kind of wind.
And you wonder how many, again, you know, there was an article this week in the New York Times about Bart Stupak. We talk about health care that's coming up. Bart Stupak will insist that his anti-abortion amendment will stay in the House bill, and if not, he will not vote for it. And he says at least another dozen Democrats will not vote for it.
I think that's a modest estimate. I think there might be more than that.
So the Democrats who relied on these, not Bart Stupak necessarily, but pro-life conservative Democrats who helped them get the majority back in 2006 and retain it in 2008, they could be in jeopardy of losing those seats. Either they become Republicans or Republicans are on the ascendancy in 2010.
They've had a margin of as much as 40 during the 111th Congress, and it's going to get smaller. And we'll be talking all year about just how much smaller it's going to get. One person we know is going to be leaving is Neil Abercrombie, a very distinguished-looking member from Hawaii who has always been easy to find on the floor due to his full beard and long ponytail.
That's right. He has announced that he will resign from Congress February 28th to focus entirely on his run for governor.
That's unusual, isn't it? I mean, for a House member to actually retire while he's running for statewide office.
You don't remember Cecil Heftel in 1990 when he did the same thing?
From the state of
Hawaii.
How about that coincidence?
Yeah, anyway, but as you well as you well know, by the way, there's another vacancy in the House. Robert Wexler from Florida
resigned. Yeah, he just didn't come back.
But Neil Abercrombie is running against Mufi Hanneman, the mayor of Honolulu, and the two of them ran against each other for Congress in 1986. You know, there's a very strong rivalry between Neil Abercrombie and Mufi Hanneman.
So a rematch with Mufi, and next week we'll talk about health care and terrorism and stuff like that.
The unimportant stuff.
That's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
Just then when the hurdy-gurdy man came singing songs of love. Then when the hurdy-gurdy man came singing songs of love.
So they just sort of hit the re-Mufi button. So she's trying to re-Mufi him from office. As we reach 60-second mark, why do we always come up with these things with 60 seconds to go?